All right. So tonight is the ninth of our Active Hope classes. And just very briefly going to cover what this chapter was about, and then I have some discussion questions that I'm going to have you pair off and talk about them, and then share back to the large group. So just to recap, in case you haven't been involved from the beginning, the reason for this series, it looks like I didn't even bring the book. Do you have a copy of it? So Active Hope is by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnstone, and it's How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy. And I really wanted to invite people to, challenge people to ask themselves whether they are doing enough to fulfill their bodhisattva vow to save all beings along with themselves. So this is the book. In our practice, in all aspects of our practice, we're responsible for ourselves. So this is a question we ask ourselves. Am I doing all that I can to fulfill my bodhisattva vow, all that my heart calls me to do, all that I feel like I'm capable of? And we answer that for ourselves. And as much as possible, do not compare ourselves to other people or try to answer that question for other people. So that's where I feel like we have a strong tradition of doing that with respect to the precepts, with respect to meditation, with respect to involvement in the Sangha, all kinds of things. It's, you know, our practice is our own. So we ask ourselves that, and, you know, and we keep asking ourselves that in a way. It's not like, yeah, I'm good. I mean, tomorrow the answer may be different, but, and then if the answer is, you know, no, or I would really like to be able to do more, then that's where this book really, I think, is really the most helpful thing that I've come across for then what? Then how do we face that? How do we not get overwhelmed by all the possibilities? How do we face the grief and overwhelm of all the things that are happening in the world and move forward and whatever? So this book is about cultivating or working on making a practice of active hope, which is really focusing on working toward what we hope for in the world, as opposed to dwelling on what we're hopeful about, positive things that we think are likely to happen. We're hopeful that, which sometimes may work and sometimes leaves us with little to go on. So instead, focusing on working toward what we hope for. So tonight's chapter is on daring to believe it is possible. So the last Act of Hope class, I think 2 weeks ago, Catching an Inspiring Vision was the chapter, and we did some imagining, you know, just brainstorming, don't say, oh, but we can't, oh, but that wouldn't happen, you know, just like, what did we imagine, you know, what's a wonderful vision of the world we could imagine. So that was sweet. And then moving from catching an inspiring vision to action, to some kind of action, kind of requires this connection to daring to believe it is possible, that some change is possible, which in some ways there's a little dynamic tension there. If active hope, you know, really doesn't have to do with our hopefulness about the outcome, but to some extent this is about, I don't know, maybe it's being convinced of our efficacy or potential efficacy of our, of maybe feeling empowered, feeling like we can make a difference. And so this chapter's full of stories, inspiring stories about people who faced, had a vision, something that they want to have come about. They faced resistance, they faced dismissal and misunderstandings, setbacks, threats, but refused to give up their vision. So I'm going to share two examples, and I'm sure many more of these can be found throughout history. And actually, this is one of the practices that they recommend for daring to believe it is possible, is actually to study and familiarize ourselves with these historical stories of people who have done this. So they talk about the example of Thomas Clarkson and William Wilberforce. So in the 1780s in England, they were at the core of a dozen people who started the Society for Effecting the Abolition of the Slave Trade. And this was just unheard of. I mean, this was just like, you know, the slave trade was like, that was just part of life. It was part of economies. Like, you know, that was ridiculous. You don't talk about getting rid of that. They tried to get laws passed over and over. These laws were called unnecessary, visionary, and impracticable. So I don't know if that sounds familiar with, you know, some of the things that we're trying to get passed right now. Just unnecessary, visionary, just visionary, impracticable. So Clarkson was nearly killed by a reactionary mob. There was a period where the office had to shut down and they couldn't meet for about, I don't know, it was like 7 to 10 years or something like that. Around the French Revolution, the British government didn't allow any, like, more than 50 people to meet, and only if they had permission. So, like, it was really squashed any kind of organizing. So it was a long time where this whole effort just went underground, and then and Clarkson has a nervous breakdown, but 1807, the British Parliament passed a law making the slave trade illegal in the British Empire. Mm. So, you know, it went from impossible to a reality. And then the other story was Chris Johnstone, the co-author of this book. I guess he trained as a medical doctor, and in the late 80s, he was an intern in London. And he said his contract was for 88 hours a week. That was the contract. And then when necessary and overtime and stuff, it was often over 100. Mm-hmm. It was hardly any sleep. Every third week, he had to work everybody went through a rota, had to work a continuous stretch between 55 to 80 hours. And during this time, the longest period of uninterrupted sleep he had was 90 minutes. And, you know, he was kind of shocked and talking to the other doctors, and they all just felt resigned and powerless. They said, yeah, this is ridiculous, but, you know, this is what you do. If you complain, then your career's at stake. But nonetheless, he joined a small campaign. He got threatened by saying, you know, you'll need to watch out for your future if you keep up with this agitating. But he went ahead. There were some protests, some high-profile actions, but kind of no real change. He became clinically depressed from sleep deprivation and sought to do some legal action, and multiple attorneys told him he had no case whatsoever, but eventually one was willing to take it up. It was thrown out. His attorney was willing to appeal, but if he appealed and lost, he would be owed all the court costs, and he didn't have that money. But people started sending letters of support and money, so he ended up bringing the case, and I guess at some point he just resigned from his medical career and really focused on this fight. A few more years passed, eventually becomes this high-profile case, tried, I guess, in the House of Lords, and it was designated a case of great significance. You know, it was going to have ramifications for society. But then the health authority settled, but it established this precedent that employers could be held accountable for pushing people that hard. And so things changed. I mean, wow. When I read about stuff like that, I'm just, And I just like recently got involved with Extinction Rebellion, and I'm getting frustrated by how disorganized they are and the communication problems. And I'm kind of like, and I'm ready just to be like, you know, I mean, really, this stuff takes so much. But the change can happen. So they talk about how a practice, I like this, a practice is a habit you choose to form. Isn't that cool? A practice is a habit you choose to form. So how can we strengthen our conviction that a better world is possible, that it is possible to make changes? So they say, you know, studying these inspiring examples from history, keeping them in mind, studying the phenomenon of discontinuous change, how it will seem like you're making no progress at all, but you don't realize you're kind of, you know, reaching a breaking point or a transition point past which, you know, actually a big change will happen. And then there's this interesting description they had of facing our threshold guardians. And to me, this sounded like kind of seeing the challenges that we face as part of the story. You know, that as we go along and we face these different obstacles, to see it almost kind of in a mythological or narrative style, that these are the challenges that are rising that you get to try to figure out, outsmart, overcome, whatever, like a protagonist. So before we get to our little breakout thing, I was just thinking about the Buddhist point of view of this stuff, and I guess what I think about is that from the Buddhist point of view, there is no objective ultimate truth. I mean, there is a kind of an, you know, ultimate absolute aspect of reality, but then it's not a relative, it's not an absolute relative truth. So in a sense, you can't, there is no like, well, are human beings capable of change or not? You know, are societies, you know, going to change? There's no yes or no answer to that. There just isn't. There is just a flowing reality and different ways for us to relate to it. And some of the ways of relating to that reality cause suffering and perpetuate greed, hate, and delusion, and all of those things. And some of the ways for us to relate to that reality lead to liberation, ease, compassion, connection. So, I mean, that's not saying that, you know, I don't know, it's not totally relativistic as if there's no truth, but in a way the truth is fluid. And so what is more fruitful? What is more healthy and effective and alive to say, you know, it's impossible to actually make any change and to just resign ourselves, or to, you know, shift our attention to cultivate this sense of positivity and hopefulness? And I think most of us would realize, you know, it's the cultivating that sense of positivity and hopefulness. And really in the course of just our daily lives, I don't know how many of you have struggled at times with anxiety or depression or despair, but we know that, I mean, we can look at this world and just see it so negatively. There's no hope, it's so bleak, there's no real warmth, there's no real compassion, there's no real, and we can see it. And then, you know, something can shift, maybe we go on medication, maybe we just work our way out of that over years or something, but then it's really the same life, it's the same world, but suddenly the clouds part and it looks completely different. We relate to it completely differently. And that is, you know, I guess that's the power of the mind. And I feel like Buddhism tells us that we have influence over that, our state of mind. We have choices that we can make that will cultivate a more, I don't know, a state of mind that lets us feel more, I mean, you might argue that that's just a, you know, just a state of mind and doesn't reflect reality, but I guess for me it feels like if I'm thinking and acting in a particular way and I keep on stumbling and causing conflict and ending up in misery, that tells me I'm working against reality. Whereas if I have another way of operating where things flow and, you know, relationships grow and it gets stuff done, that to me suggests that's more in harmony with reality, the underlying reality, because I'm moving in harmony with it. I'm moving according to the truth. So questions that I was going to have people just pair off and discuss. And everybody has a copy of the questions so that you can refresh yourself. So I define active hope on here just for reference. Active hope is something we do rather than have. Active hope means we focus on working toward what we hope for in the world rather than basing our sense of positivity only on those outcomes we feel hopeful will come about. Still, in order to maintain our active hope, our energy and effort, so in this case, we could be thinking about active hope as, I don't know, it's difficult to put your finger on, but it doesn't have to just be about, you know, environmental issues or social change or something, but just kind of that sense of, I don't know, agency and efficacy and relative positivity. So in order to maintain our active hope, we also have to dare to believe change is possible. So the questions, when, if you're able to practice active hope, at least sometimes, what helps you to do that? Or in order to build and sustain active hope, what kind of things do you do or what do you focus on? So I'm hoping that we'll end up being able to share some wisdom tonight. But the second question, kind of an or question, if you find active hope elusive in your life, I mean, you can answer both of these if you want, but if you kind of like, I don't know, I don't even know about this active hope thing, I find it really difficult to relate to or summon it, can you formulate at least one question about how to practice it? Can you formulate at least one question about how to practice it? You know, as you contemplate practicing it, what question arises? How do you face or how do you? So, pass these out. Should be one for everybody, and then if you could just pair off, and I'll let it go until it seems like things are dying down. So, did anybody come up with any questions about how to?
I have a question that I didn't bring it up. But how do you sustain hope? Like when you are working in a field, so I'm thinking of my past as an educator, working in my field, and you know, you go in, I'll go home, like, I'm gonna change the world, I'm gonna change all these things. They're going to love science, and they're going to be such good scientists. And then you face the reality, and then, especially when I was working at a low income, high mobility area, and I mean, they're just, their problems were so beyond what I did every day. Like, just education is not that important. You don't have your needs. So, just have, and then when you have a social structure, like a system, or like right now, like when we have class sizes in kindergarten, some class sizes are 34. So, how do you sustain after, you know, I worked 10 years, and yes, I can, you get some glimmers of hope, and you get some, you know, students that you've, you know, you've impacted, but how do you sustain? It's just so hard when the system is so not set up, and these kids need so much more help than what you're giving, so I don't, or all of the other, how do you keep going? How do you keep trying along and thinking, am I on the right path? It's more of just like, am I on the right, am I doing enough? Am I focusing enough? Because it doesn't feel like I can give enough. It's, they need so much more than this.
I would say that they do need so much more than that, right? Mm-hmm. But you can't put the weight of the world on your shoulders. I mean, if you can just manage to move the needle that much, that's our best. That's, you know, we do what we do, what you can.
I know that, but I've never fallen off. I never felt like it. Like my dad always said, like, you can only do the best you can do. You just have to do what you got. But it just was like watching the ship sinking. Mm-hmm. I don't know. So.
Yeah. Well, as you're describing that, I saw lots of heads nodding. So, any other reflections on this universal quandary, if you try to do anything good?
What I like to think of is I'm piloting a boat or a ship or a plane, and I'm trying to make a change in the course. And I've only got such limited control. I can do maybe a tenth of a degree, you know, maybe 2/10 of a degree. But I do that every time I can. It, you know, I'm trying to steer, say, left to port. Just a little bit each time, little bit each time. And the waves are coming at me in the boat. That throws the bow off to starboard and go back to putting it off to port. You've got to have that, excuse me, faith that what you're doing is making a difference. You just keep doing the thing that is working. And over time, you'll get the bow of that boat around. Hmm. Especially in heavy seas, in rough water, it's tough. Because quite often, you see all of your hard work, you know, 5 degrees off to starboard, and you've got to start all over again. Hmm. But you got to keep that. The question I have for you, Doug, was how do you support people and yourself, basically, to keep up the faith that can be done, that what you're doing is the right thing in the right direction.
No.
I was hoping the wisdom would come from all. We should have made it more of a circle.
I'm thinking of Martin Luther King and his vision that his belief in the evolution of the world was love, and that even though he wouldn't see all of the change that he had hoped for within his lifetime, that he did seem to have a fairly unshakable belief in that evolution of love was what was happening in humankind, that is the driving force within humanity, despite all the evidence to the contrary, that there is an evolution toward love. And that struck me in the readings that I've done of his, to, like you said, to have that faith. I work in community mental health, and it's very much a same kind of thing. I don't have enough resources. Every day I have people coming asking for things I can't give them. But what I can give them is my compassion. I can sit with them and listen to them and care for them. Even if it's just to offer a glass of water, I would just encourage not underestimating the power of that gesture. The power of the time that there is, that would bring that sense of love and compassion to that person through your action. We never know really what it what it does within another person.
One of the things I heard Bob ask was, how do you know if that you're doing the right thing? And the fact of the matter is, you may not be doing the right thing. But one of the wonderful things I got out of sitting and talking with Ruth Ann is, because I remember now that I have done this in the past, is talk to people about it. Am I doing the right thing here? Because I feel like I'm getting nowhere. Mm-hmm. And then other people will say, I feel like I'm getting nowhere too. Maybe we can work on something together. Mm-hmm. Maybe we can, there's a whole other way to be steering. I've tried it before, maybe you can try it, you know, but I totally get the whole love and compassion thing, and I think to me that's at the heart of what we're talking about. That's the fundamental part of it. But, you know, getting through all the crap, for lack of a better term, requires more than just my own, this is what I think I can do. You know, and, you know, to the point of not taking the world on your shoulders, I mean, I experienced that earlier this week. It is not up to me. It's just not up to me. I can only do what I can do. Mm-hmm. And, but if I talk to somebody else, we can do more. I hate to sound like I'm being, you know, some kind of cheerleader or something, but, you know, if you just put more than one mind on it, mm-hmm. it can be incredibly helpful, and it can sustain the faith in what you're trying to do.
You can't change the world. You can only change yourself. And you were talking about trying to change these children, but they flow through your life so fast. You see hundreds of them in a career, thousands in a career. You have probably a couple of children you see every day. If you change yourself, live by your principles, those children can be influenced. And those children's friends can also be influenced. And so, living a principled life by your own principles, not worrying about the outcome, but fulfilling your own expectations for yourself without worrying, am I doing the right thing? I'm doing this right because it feels right. Mm-hmm. I am helping this person just by being a right for myself.
And thanks for offering the question. I didn't want this to turn into a let's give Julie Vice. Because I feel like any of these questions, I mean, it takes courage just to formulate them, and that we revisit them all the time. I mean, I don't think these questions are something that you just answer and then you're good.
Well, I think that when you have doubt, I think doubt is healthy when you have expectations and intentions that don't match reality. And this isn't necessarily directed right, but it is, kind of. Then that doubt is healthy. I mean, it's good. And maybe there's a better way for you to meet your intention than the way you're currently doing it. I don't know, you know. So maybe it's a little bit different than what other people are saying. But ultimately, I think it does come down to your internal values. You know, are you meeting your internal value? Are you, you know, values is a big thing for me these days. But I think that's what you have to ask yourself. And I think it's okay to ask yourself that all the time. I mean, it sucks, kind of, but, you know, what else you got to do?
It also strikes me that I've read all about Martin Luther King and Gandhi and Mother Teresa, and I just, you know, how do you become one of these people and,
you know, touch so many lives and be so effective and be so dedicated? And but I guess I've kind of come to conclusion in a way that, like, yeah, it was partly them and it was partly their circumstances as well. And I think a lot of us just end up like, I don't know, I'm in this part of the boat and I'm bailing. I don't really see what else I can do right now. I mean, like, maybe we're not doing the right, like, sometimes with the best of our intentions, like the opportunity to really do something substantial or to really do the thing that's close to our hearts or something, just, maybe we could be positive. We could say it hasn't arisen yet.
Say what?
It hasn't arisen yet. We could be really optimistic about it. I don't know. I feel like, you know, for myself, I'm really waiting for, you know, a movement that's willing to do civil disobedience, to call, to put pressures on our governments and to, you know, force action on climate change. I'm excited about that, but it's not easy. It's like, yeah, there's doing it in the UK and there's a Portland chapter and it's got to get organized and who's doing what and whatever, and everybody just keeps on putting off any kind of really disruptive or potentially arrestable action in order to, you know, build relationships and attract more people. And, you know, and it takes like a couple people to disrupt things enough to get media attention. If you do it right, you know, it's not like we have to wait until there's thousands of people. So even within the people who like that idea, it may not be time yet. So it's kind of like, duh.
As a poet, I like the expression of starting with, in the meantime. Working in a service profession, a couple of times I would think of a student or a patient where I thought, just today, just being in this job, was there some consistency that came to their day today? Mm-hmm. Just because that person and being in that group with me, I mean, because I was the one supposedly in charge, but did that bring to their day, this day, some consistency? I mean, on an emotional level. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I read this in a Buddhist book or not, but sometimes hanging in the doubt becomes too much of a luxury and a distraction. So it's like, what was the chop wood, carry water, what you do after you've been enlightened, chop wood, carry water. So.
Yeah, there's a our practice doesn't give us one answer. Is it time to go, wait a second, I don't think this is helping. This is not okay. There's time for that. And then I know that I am definitely guilty of standing on the sidelines going like, what would be the most useful, the most fulfilling, the absolute best use of my time? Like this whole self-centered, like, you know, maximize Donio's efficacy in the world. Like, no, I don't think, no, that looks too slow. No. And then I don't do anything, you know? So, yeah.
And then there's that ego, like, you know, yes. I'm going to change the world. You go to the mirror in your 20s. Yeah, I'm not there. And making it all better. Like, it's on me. Like, you know, I mean, it's this like ego thing that you have to be like, shake it off, and what can I do within my realm? And being, that's kind of a humble, it's humbling.
Yeah.
To go, it might not make any change. I might not have any positive effect. I might not. So like how, you know, I think throwing that ego out too, it's like challenging. You know, being like, I can do so much. Mm. And I'm gonna get this, you know, these kids are gonna be inspired, you know, whatever it is, like you're gonna do all these things, and then it's like, well, cool, like,
maybe I will be consistent for one of the kids.
Yes, exactly.
One day.
Yes.
You know, yeah, it's like, all right, this was my dream. This now.
But then it's like, well, yeah, is it worth? Was that worth it? Like, it's like what Jana was saying. Like, is that really?
I think discontent is good.
Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm.
Discontent is good. Mm-hmm. You may be working within your principles, but that discontent can drive you to find new ways, new avenues. Mm-hmm. This isn't working. what can I change? What is right thing to do here? What path? Should I just totally go do something else? Would I be better in another role? Or should I just redouble my effort here? That discontentment with the result, I think, is important. We can't get too comfortable with saying, well, I'm doing the right thing, and that's good enough. It's like, I'm doing the right thing. What is it? Result?
I still come back to the fundamental thing. It's all about us and people and being together and looking after each other. I read a very remarkable thing last night. There's a brand new book out, Gods of the Upper Air. Have you heard that? It's about the original anthropologists and the professor who is the professor of Margaret Mead, who encouraged her to go to Samoa, but it's about how they all turned the thinking world on its ear by describing, you know, who said white is the thing? Who said, you know, male or female is the only thing? I mean, they just challenged gender, race, ethnicity, everything. And this professor was starting out, and he went on a trip to Baffin Island, and first, one of the things he did was he struck up a conversation with everybody apropos of our thing about asking people questions and talking about, you know, what interests you and how would you do this and that kind of thing. But the most remarkable thing about it was that they were all coming off of the Age of Enlightenment, and he said, you know, I go out here in the snow, and the only way I know if I'm getting frostbitten is if the person that I'm with looks at me and tells me my skin doesn't look right. So he said, you know, we have to work together, we have to be around each other. It's a little bit contrary to what I think I learned at Great Bow in Rohatsu one year, but it really drove home the point about being together, working together, community, more so than ever, but it struck me in my Buddhist thinking very quickly.
So, well, we just have a couple minutes left, so anybody who hasn't said much yet?
Can I say
nothing? Yeah, yeah. You didn't say much, so yeah, go ahead.
This isn't very Buddhist or spiritual, but one way to motivate myself is just, like, what's the alternative? So, should we leave the Earth habitable for future generations, or should we not do that? it's kind of black and white, really.
Yeah.
I feel like I have to do something. I don't have a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Always start small and move in concentric circles outwards.
Mm-hmm. Begin with the research.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah? Do. You know, we can BS ourselves. You know, get out of our heads and do it. Mm-hmm. That's the integrity of it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Conversation in a little sense moving on, but thinking in terms of that tendency to feel overwhelmed, I was talking to a friend about regret the other day, and I said, hey, there's a couple things I've done in my life that were ruthlessly difficult, losing situations, and I go back and do them again in a heartbeat, because the person I am today could have done them better.
Hmm.
Not one of them, just done them better. And that's how I know that they were worth doing, even though I regret them. And I think that I just kind of want to say, like, there's nothing wrong with having something you can't back down from, right? And if in your heart you can't stop, then you have to keep going, right?
Hmm. Any last thoughts? I know Stephanie and Grant were having quite a conversation back there. I mean, not to put you on the spot.
Well, a question I was asking myself on how to have, I guess, active hope for me, I guess, in my life, where I have periods of having, like, being extremely productive, accomplishing my goals or changing my habits and stuff like that. Then after, like, 3 weeks, just a down period where I just don't feel like doing anything, just, like, hard on myself. And so I think my problem is, like, more having the right perspective and stop having the right perspective on, I guess, like, my progress in achieving my goals, but also not being so egoistic about just thinking about myself, my goals.
Well, everyone was really inspiring with what they were saying, and it just kind of reminded me of something that happened to Bob Marley, and there was a in the 70s, there was an assassination attempt on him. Mm-hmm. And the next day, he went out and did a show. Mm-hmm. And a journalist came and interviewed him, and they said, why did you go do this? You know people are trying to kill you with what you're doing. And he said, oh, yeah, evil and wicked people don't take that day off, so why should I?
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like a good note to end on. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.